It's March 14, 2006. Jeff Barr, an Amazon developer evangelist, not a senior VP, not a product lead, a developer evangelist, publishes a blog post announcing a service called Amazon Simple Storage Service, S3. Store any amount of data in the cloud, pay by the gigabyte, no servers, no upfront commitment. The post is about 800 words long. It reads like a tutorial.
Nobody notices. The tech press is still obsessed with the social networking wars. News Corp had acquired MySpace for $580 million the year before, and the entire media industry is arguing about whether Rupert Murdoch is a genius or a fool. The blog post that effectively launches cloud computing, the infrastructure layer that'll underpin the next two decades of software, is buried beneath social network gossip.
The most important product announcement of the 21st century was a blog post that nobody read.
That's poetic and infuriating in equal measure.
Welcome back to Silicon Valley Strategy. I'm Myra D'Amico.
And I'm Travis Carlyle. This is episode 11. A blog post that nobody read. That's the kind of moment this show exists to surface. The decisions that look like nothing at the time and turn out to be everything.
And today we're doing Amazon Part 2. If Part 1 was the retail story, the online bookstore, the everything store, the maniacal focus on the customer, Part 2 is the story of how Amazon quietly became three companies wearing a trench coat, and how the financial architecture of that three-company structure is the most underappreciated strategic weapon in technology.
I mean, I think the central claim of this episode is going to be controversial for people who think they understand Amazon. Because the conventional narrative is, Amazon is an e-commerce company that also does cloud computing. And what we're going to argue is that Amazon is actually a cloud computing and advertising company that subsidizes a logistics empire. The retail operation is the cost center. AWS and advertising are the profit centers. And the blended financial statements, the ones Wall Street looks at, are designed to obscure this fact.
That's a strong claim, and we're going to back it up with numbers. But first, trivia. And this one's about the accidental announcement of cloud computing. Here's the question. AWS was technically revealed before Amazon was ready. Jeff Barr published information about S3 in a blog post before the formal press strategy was in place. What was the dominant technology news story that week that buried the announcement?
If you're playing along, pause now.
The answer, MySpace. News Corp's acquisition of MySpace for $580 million the previous July was still dominating the conversation. Every tech journalist in the world was writing about whether social networking was a fad or the future of the internet. S3. The storage service that had become the foundation of cloud computing, launched into a news cycle that could not have cared less.
And here's the beautiful irony. MySpace is gone, destroyed essentially by a company we'll cover in the next two episodes. The thing the press was covering became worthless. The thing the press ignored became the infrastructure of the modern internet.
Rupert Murdoch's $580 million is a rounding error. Jeff Barr's blog post is a $90 billion business. The press has never had a worse week.
Someone should send Murdoch a link.
The blog post that nobody read in March 2006 was the beginning of what's now a $90 billion annual revenue business.
This is why we do the show, because the moments that matter are almost never the moments that get covered.
All right, let's get into it. Let's set the stage. What does the tech landscape look like in 2006?
Okay, so the first thing to understand is the infrastructure problem. In 2006, if you're a startup and you want to launch a web application, you have to buy servers, physical servers. You have to lease rack space in a data center. You have to hire system administrators. You have to estimate your traffic in advance and buy enough capacity to handle your peak load, even though your average load might be one-tenth of that. The upfront capital required to launch a web startup is tens of thousands of dollars at minimum, and for anything at scale, hundreds of thousands.
Put yourself in the shoes of a two-person startup in 2005. You've got an idea for a web application. Before you write a single line of application code, you need to solve an infrastructure problem. You need servers. You need networking. You need storage. You need monitoring. You need security. You need someone who knows how to configure Apache and MySQL and Linux and all the rest. That's not your product. That's the tax you pay before you can start building your product.
And the incumbents, the companies selling this infrastructure, are IBM, Oracle, Sun Microsystems, HP, Dell. These are companies that sell enterprise hardware and software on multi-year licensing contracts. Their entire business model is built on upfront capital expenditure. You buy the servers, you buy the software licenses, you sign a 3-year maintenance contract. The sales cycle is months long. The minimum commitment is enormous.
I think what people don't appreciate is how much this infrastructure cost shaped what got built. If it costs $100,000 just to get servers running before you have a single user, then the only companies that get started are the ones that can raise $100,000 for infrastructure. The capital requirements filter out an enormous number of ideas. And that's counterpositioning waiting to happen. A massive installed base of incumbents charging enterprise prices, and a generation of developers who resent paying them.
And here's the thing. Amazon is sitting on something nobody else has. They've spent years building internal infrastructure tools, the APIs and services that let their own engineering teams provision computing resources. They've been forced to do this because their e-commerce operation is so large and so spiky. Think Christmas traffic versus February traffic, that they had to build extremely sophisticated systems for allocating computing capacity dynamically.
Someone inside Amazon, and there's genuine debate about exactly who deserves the credit, looks at this internal infrastructure and has the insight. If we need this, and we're one of the largest web operations in the world, then every other company building for the web needs this too. What if we sold it?
That someone is most commonly credited as Andy Jassy, who later became Amazon's CEO, was Jeff Bezos' shadow, his technical advisor, essentially his chief of staff, in the early 2000s. Though the origin story has multiple credible versions.
So the world in 2006 is a world where every startup is solving the same infrastructure problem independently. The incumbents are selling infrastructure on terms that are hostile to small companies, and Amazon has quietly built the solution internally without realizing it was a product.
Let me actually break down how AWS came to exist, because the conventional narrative, Amazon had spare server capacity and decided to rent it out, is maybe 20% accurate.
You're being generous at 20%.
Fair. The real story starts around 2000 or 2001, when Amazon's engineering organization is growing rapidly and teams are finding that they spend an enormous amount of time building the same infrastructure components over and over. Every team that wants to launch a new feature needs compute, storage, databases, messaging queues, and every team is building its own versions of these components.
AWS was literally born because Amazon engineers got tired of rebuilding the same infrastructure for every new project. Not a CEO's grand vision. Not a strategy offsite on a whiteboard. Frustration. The mundane daily frustration of a software engineer who has to spend 3 weeks setting up a database before writing a single line of product code. That's the origin of a $90 billion business.
Wait. I want to make sure that lands. The most important cloud computing company in the world started because internal engineers were annoyed. Not because a CEO had a vision deck. Because people were tired of doing the same work twice. The best infrastructure products almost always start this way. Not from market analysis, but from someone saying, I can't believe I have to do this again.
And the classic large organization problem. Dozens of engineering teams, each independently solving infrastructure problems, each building slightly different versions of the same tools, each reinventing wheels. The coordination cost is enormous. The inconsistency is maddening. It's the kind of thing that makes talented engineers leave for startups where they can actually build product instead of plumbing.
So Amazon starts building internal services, standardized APIs that any team inside Amazon can call to provision infrastructure. You need storage? Here's an API for that. You need compute? Here's an API for that. You need a database? API. This isn't altruism. This is operational efficiency. Amazon's building these tools because the alternative, every team building its own infrastructure is too slow and too expensive.
And the key architectural decision, the one that makes everything else possible, is that these internal services are built as clean, decoupled APIs. They're not tightly integrated into Amazon's retail application. They're standalone services that happen to be used by Amazon's retail teams, but they could, in principle, be used by anyone. That decoupling is the precondition for the entire AWS story. If the internal tools had been messy, coupled, single purpose, if they'd been optimized only for Amazon's own retail stack, they couldn't have been externalized. The leap from internal tool to external product requires that the tool was built with enough abstraction to serve more than one master.
Andy Jassy recognizes this. He brings the insight to Bezos. And Bezos, this is a critical Bezos moment, doesn't say that's a distraction from our retail business. He says something much more interesting. He says, and I'm paraphrasing from multiple accounts, if we need this, then this is a real need. And if it's a real need, then there's a market. Bezos applies his own customer obsession framework. Amazon is the first customer of its own infrastructure, and Amazon's needs are representative of a much larger market's needs.
Hold on, say that again. Amazon is the first customer of its own infrastructure. That's the whole insight in one sentence. They dog-fooded their way into a $90 billion business, and it's the purest example of what I'd call internal platform externalization. You build something for yourself, you realize it solves a universal problem, and you sell it. Slack did this. Google's MapReduce did this. But nobody did it at the scale or with the consequences of AWS.
That's such a Bezos move, though. Most CEOs hear, we built an internal tool, and think, protect it. Guard the proprietary advantage. Keep the competitors from getting access to the infrastructure that makes your own operation run. Bezos hears it and thinks, sell it. He understands that selling the infrastructure doesn't diminish Amazon's advantage. It creates a new revenue stream that funds the advantage. The internal tool becomes a profit center that cross-subsidizes the retail operation, which, as we'll see, is the financial architecture that makes the whole thing work.
What gets me about this moment is the leap of imagination required. Amazon is a retailer. In 2003, nobody at Amazon, including most of the engineering team, thinks of Amazon as an infrastructure company. The idea that your internal tools could be your most valuable product isn't obvious. It's the opposite of obvious. Most companies guard their internal tools as proprietary advantage. Amazon looked at its internal tools and said, "What if we sold them?"
S3 launches March 2006. EC2, Elastic Compute Cloud, the virtual server product, launches in August 2006. The pricing model is revolutionary. Pay by the hour for compute, pay by the gigabyte for storage. No upfront commitment, no minimum contract, no sales call required. You sign up with a credit card and you've got servers running in minutes.
Credit card sign up, servers in minutes. Versus IBM, where you sign a purchase order, wait 6 weeks for hardware delivery, hire a systems integrator, and begin a 3-month implementation project. That pricing model is textbook counterpositioning. The incumbents literally can't match it without cannibalizing their multi-year licensing revenue. Same dynamic we saw with Intel versus the mainframe makers. A disruptive model that the incumbent can't adopt without destroying itself.
Except AWS did it to an entire category of incumbents simultaneously. IBM, Oracle, Sun, HP, Dell, all of them trapped on the wrong side of the counterposition.
One blog post, 5 industries disrupted.
The early adopters are startups. Dropbox, Netflix, Pinterest, Airbnb. These are companies that can't afford and don't want to spend time on building their own data centers. AWS gives them infrastructure that scales automatically. If your traffic doubles overnight, you don't call a sales rep, you just use more. The bill goes up, but the service doesn't go down.
And this is where the scale economies kick in, and the flywheel starts spinning. More startups use AWS. AWS generates more revenue. Amazon reinvests the revenue in more data centers, more services, more features. The service gets better and cheaper, which attracts more customers, which generates more revenue. The scale economies are enormous because the marginal cost of serving one more customer on existing infrastructure is close to zero. Each rotation of the flywheel deepens the moat.
Now I want to zoom out and talk about what Amazon actually is by, let's say, 2020. Because by that point, the financial architecture is fully visible if you know where to look, and most people don't look.
Give us the numbers.
Okay, so let's actually break this down. Amazon reports consolidated revenue, consolidated operating income, and the blended numbers look like a company running on razor-thin margins, 2 to 3% operating margin, sometimes lower. And the narrative that gets built from those blended numbers is Amazon is a low-margin company that prioritizes growth over profit. Jeff Bezos doesn't care about making money. Amazon is a charity that delivers packages.
The charity narrative, that's the Bezos magic trick. He got Wall Street to value him like a growth company while printing money like a software company.
And nobody noticed for a decade. But when you disaggregate the segments, which Amazon is required to do in its financial filings, a completely different picture emerges. AWS runs at approximately 30% operating margins. 30%. That's higher than most software companies. It's in the range of Microsoft's margins.
And the retail business?
The North American retail business runs at low single-digit margins, 2, 3, sometimes 4%. The international retail business often runs at a loss. And then there's the third business, which is the one I think is the most underappreciated line item in all of corporate finance, advertising.
Amazon advertising. This is the business that almost nobody outside of e-commerce talks about.
Amazon's advertising revenue reaches approximately $47 billion annually. The operating margins are estimated, Amazon doesn't fully break them out, to be in the range of 50 to 70%. This is a business that's structurally superior to Google search advertising in one critical dimension. The person seeing the ad is already on Amazon. They're already in a purchase context. They've already demonstrated purchase intent by searching for a product. The ad isn't interrupting them. The ad is helping them find the thing they already want to buy.
Wait. 50 to 70% margins on $47 billion in revenue? That's potentially $30 billion in operating profit from a business that most analysts barely mention?
That's the number, and it's growing faster than either retail or AWS.
Okay, so this is the insight I keep thinking about. When you search Google for running shoes, you might be researching, you might be comparing, you might be writing an article about running shoes. You might not buy anything. When you search Amazon for running shoes, you are buying running shoes. Today. Right now. The purchase intent is qualitatively different, and that difference is worth billions in advertising premium.
Which means the CPM, the cost per thousand impressions, and more importantly, the return on ad spend is dramatically higher for Amazon advertisers than for Google advertisers in product categories. A brand that advertises running shoes on Amazon reaches someone who is statistically within minutes of making a purchase. That's premium advertising. That commands premium prices.
So let me make sure I've got the picture. Amazon is three businesses: business one, retail and logistics, enormous revenue, low margins, massive capital expenditure on warehouses, trucks, planes. Business two, AWS, large revenue, high margins, capital expenditure on data centers, but with strong scale economies. Business three, advertising, large and growing revenue, very high margins, almost zero incremental cost.
And the strategic magic, the thing that makes Amazon's financial architecture a competitive weapon, is cross-subsidization. Businesses 2 and 3 generate the profit that funds Business 1. AWS margins pay for Amazon's logistics build-out. Advertising margins pay for Prime Video, for Alexa development, for the subsidies on the Echo device. The blended financial statement shows a company making 2% margins. The reality is a company making 30% margins on cloud and 60% margins on advertising, and deliberately reinvesting those profits into an e-commerce and logistics infrastructure that competitors can't afford to match.
Well, wait, I want to push back on deliberately. Are you saying Bezos is intentionally using AWS profits to subsidize retail? Or is this an emergent structure?
I think it starts as emergent and becomes deliberate. In the early days, AWS profits are a happy surprise that allows Amazon to invest more aggressively in retail. By 2015 or so, it's clearly strategic. The 2015 shareholder letter is the one where Bezos starts discussing AWS as a separate segment in detail. He knows that the analyst community has figured out the cross-subsidization, and he's fine with it. Because by that point, the moat is deep enough that knowing about it doesn't help you compete with it.
That's the ultimate power move. Yeah, I'm cross-subsidizing. What are you going to do about it?
The answer is nothing. Because to compete, you'd need your own AWS and your own advertising platform. The cross-subsidization isn't just a financial trick, it's a structural moat. The profits from AWS and advertising fund a logistics operation that no pure-play retailer can match. Walmart can compete on retail, Google can compete on cloud, nobody can compete on all three simultaneously. The cross-subsidization makes the whole thing defensible, precisely because it requires competing on three fronts at once.
I want to talk about Alexa and the Echo, because I think it represents both the strength and the limitation of Amazon's approach.
The Echo launches in November 2014. It's a voice-controlled speaker. The core product idea is, what if Amazon were in your kitchen? What if you could order paper towels by speaking aloud? What if the friction between wanting something and buying something were reduced to a voice command?
And the strategic logic is sound. Amazon's relationship with the customer historically ends at the checkout page. You buy something, Amazon ships it, the transaction is done. Amazon has no persistent presence in your life between purchases. The Echo is an attempt to put Amazon into your home permanently, to be the ambient interface through which you interact with commerce.
And it works initially. Amazon sells over 100 million Echo devices. Alexa becomes a recognizable brand. The tech press declares the voice computing era has arrived.
But here's the thing I keep thinking about. Did people actually buy things through Alexa? Because the bear case on the Echo was always that voice commerce is a terrible shopping experience. When you buy running shoes, you want to see photos. You want to read reviews. You want to compare prices. You don't want to say, Alexa, buy me running shoes, and trust that the algorithm will choose correctly.
And the data bears this out. Voice commerce never reached meaningful scale as a percentage of Amazon's total orders. People used Alexa for timers, for weather, for music. They didn't use it for shopping in the way Amazon hoped.
Amazon reportedly lost over $10 billion on the Alexa division. Massive layoffs in the Alexa team in 2022 and 2023.
Which is, I want to be fair here, exactly the kind of bet that Amazon's financial architecture enables. And this circles back to the cross-subsidization story. Amazon can afford to spend $10 billion on an experiment that doesn't work because AWS and advertising are throwing off enough cash to absorb the loss. For any other retailer, a $10 billion failed experiment would be existential. For Amazon, it's a write-down. The same financial architecture that creates the moat also funds the mistakes.
That's the cross-subsidization story in miniature. The high-margin businesses don't just fund the competitive moat, they fund the freedom to be wrong, and $10 billion worth of wrong at that.
I keep thinking about this in the context of the Fairchild story. Fairchild couldn't keep talent because the parent company wouldn't share the upside. Amazon has the opposite problem. So much upside from AWS and ads that it can subsidize experiments that would sink a normal company. Same financial architecture principle, completely different outcome.
And that's the double-edged sword. It enables bold bets. It also enables bets that should have been killed earlier, but weren't because the company could afford to keep funding them.
That's a fair critique. Bezos' famous line is, "We're stubborn on vision, flexible on details." The Alexa experience suggests that sometimes the line between stubborn on vision and throwing good money after bad is thinner than you think.
By the way, if moments like this are grabbing you, the online course we built goes even deeper. It's at svstrategy.xyz. That's svstrategy.xyz. You can explore mystery company simulations where the name is hidden and you have to identify the strategy before the reveal. It's genuinely fun. svstrategy.xyz.
So let's pull together the powers that have been showing up throughout this story. Because AWS is one of those rare businesses where you can watch multiple powers compound in real time.
We've been naming them as they appear. Let's make it explicit.
Power 1, scale economies. We touched on this with the flywheel. AWS is one of the purest examples of supply-side scale economies in modern business. Data centers have enormous fixed costs, the land, the buildings, the power infrastructure, the cooling systems, the networking equipment. but the marginal cost of adding one more virtual machine to an existing data center is close to zero. So as AWS adds customers, the fixed costs are spread across a larger base. The per-unit cost falls, and Amazon can either pocket the difference as margin or pass the savings to customers as price reductions.
And they've done both.
They've done both. Amazon has cut AWS prices more than 100 times since launch. Every price cut makes it harder for a smaller competitor to match them. Because a smaller competitor has the same fixed costs, you still have to build a data center, but fewer customers to spread those costs across. The scale advantage compounds over time.
But wait. Google and Microsoft both have scale. Google Cloud Platform and Azure aren't small operations. Does the scale economy argument hold when you've got two or three players at comparable scale?
It holds, but with diminishing returns relative to each other. The scale economy power is most powerful against the long tail of would-be competitors, the IBMs, the Oracles, the smaller cloud providers. Against Google and Microsoft specifically, the scale advantage narrows. But AWS has a second power that's arguably more defensible.
Switching costs. We saw this one coming from the moment they launched, with proprietary APIs.
Exactly. And this is the one I think is the most underappreciated moat in technology right now. When a company builds on AWS, they don't just rent servers. They build on AWS-specific APIs. They use S3's specific storage interface. They use DynamoDB's specific database model. They use Lambda's specific serverless architecture. They use SQS for messaging, SNS for notifications, CloudWatch for monitoring, IAM for access control. Every service has its own proprietary API.
And the more services you use, the deeper the integration. It's a ratchet mechanism. Every new AWS service a customer adopts makes it harder to leave.
The switching cost isn't, how hard is it to move my virtual machines to Google Cloud? The switching cost is, how hard is it to rewrite every piece of code that calls an AWS-specific API? For a large enterprise with thousands of microservices, the answer is, it'd take years and cost millions of dollars. And during the migration, you're running on two clouds simultaneously, which doubles your infrastructure cost. The economic incentive to stay on AWS is enormous, and it increases with every service you adopt.
And Amazon knows this, which is why they launch dozens of new services every year at reInvent, their annual developer conference in Las Vegas. Each new service isn't just a revenue line. It's another lock-in mechanism. It's the internal platform externalization strategy taken to its logical extreme. Every internal tool Amazon builds for itself becomes an external service that deepens the switching cost.
Now, I want to be honest about the tension here. Is that actually a power, or is it just vendor lock-in dressed up in fancy language? Because there's a version of this that's customer hostile. You're making it hard for your customers to leave. That's not the same as making your product so good that your customers don't want to leave.
I think the answer is, it's both. The switching costs are real, and they're partly artificial, proprietary APIs that could have been open standards but weren't. But the services are also genuinely good. S3 is genuinely the best object storage product on the market. The switching cost wouldn't exist if customers didn't adopt the services in the first place, and they adopted them because the products work.
And the third power, counterpositioning. We told this story as it happened in the narrative, but let me make it explicit. This is about why IBM and Oracle, the companies that dominated enterprise IT before AWS, couldn't respond effectively. AWS's pricing model is pay-per-use. No upfront commitment, no multi-year contract, no sales team required. IBM and Oracle's entire business was built on the opposite model: multi-year licensing agreements, large upfront payments, dedicated sales teams, professional services engagements. For IBM or Oracle to match AWS's pricing model, they'd have had to destroy their existing revenue streams. A customer paying IBM $500,000 per year for a server license isn't going to continue paying $500,000 per year if IBM simultaneously offers the same compute for $50,000 on a pay-per-use model. The existing customer base would migrate to the cheaper option, so IBM and Oracle were structurally unable to compete on price without cannibalizing themselves.
The innovator's dilemma applied to infrastructure. Same pattern as the Fairchild story, the Intel story, the Apple story. the incumbent's greatest strength becomes the cage that traps them.
And by the time IBM and Oracle recognized the threat and tried to build cloud offerings, AWS had a 5 to 7 year head start, thousands of enterprise customers locked in through switching costs and the scale economies to underprice anything IBM could offer. Counterpositioning gave AWS the initial window. Scale economies and switching costs made the window permanent.
So the three powers compound. Scale economies make the product cheaper. Switching costs make customers stay. Counterpositioning prevented incumbents from responding. Each power reinforces the others into something close to an impregnable position.
It's arguably the most defensible competitive position in technology. More defensible than Google's search monopoly. More defensible than Apple's iOS ecosystem. Because unlike search or smartphones, where the user can switch with minimal cost, an enterprise that's built its entire technical infrastructure on AWS can't switch without an effort measured in years and millions of dollars. Let me lay out the two frameworks from this story that I think generalize beyond Amazon.
Go.
Framework one, cross-subsidization as strategy. Amazon's financial architecture isn't an accident. It's a deliberate strategic design in which high-margin businesses, AWS and advertising, generate the cash that funds low-margin or negative-margin businesses. Retail, logistics, Prime Video, Alexa. The key insight is that the blended financial statement obscures the true economics. When an analyst looks at Amazon's consolidated 2% operating margin and concludes, this is a low-margin business, they're making an error. Amazon isn't a low-margin business. It's a collection of businesses at dramatically different margins, and the high-margin businesses are funding the construction of moats around the low-margin businesses.
And the strategic implication is that no competitor can match Amazon's retail pricing because no competitor has AWS and advertising profits to subsidize with. Walmart can match Amazon's retail prices, but Walmart can't simultaneously invest in a cloud computing business and an advertising platform and a streaming service and a logistics network and a hardware ecosystem. The cross-subsidization creates an asymmetric war.
Hold on. I want to be precise here. Walmart actually does have an advertising business that's growing, and Walmart has cloud partnerships. So the cross-subsidization advantage isn't absolute, but the magnitude is different. Amazon's high-margin businesses generate tens of billions in operating profit that can be redirected. Walmart's non-retail businesses are much smaller.
Framework two?
The infrastructure company versus the product company. This is a distinction that I think matters enormously for how you evaluate technology businesses. A product company builds something that customers use directly. A product company's value is in the user experience, the brand, the design. An infrastructure company builds the platform on which products are built. An infrastructure company's value is in the switching costs, the scale economies, the network effects within the developer ecosystem.
And your argument is that Amazon is fundamentally an infrastructure company that happens to also sell products.
My argument is that the infrastructure businesses, AWS and the advertising platform, are structurally more valuable per dollar of revenue than the product businesses, retail, and devices. Because infrastructure businesses have switching costs and scale economies that product businesses often don't. You can switch from buying paper towels on Amazon to buying them at Target with zero switching cost. You can't switch your cloud infrastructure from AWS to Google Cloud without a multi-year engineering effort.
See, I want to push back on this because I think you're undervaluing the retail side. Prime membership, 200 million members globally, is itself an infrastructure play. Once you've paid $139 for Prime, your purchase behavior changes. You default to Amazon for everything because you've already paid the shipping cost. The behavioral economics of the sunk cost are powerful.
That's a good point. Prime is a hybrid. It's a product that creates infrastructure-like switching costs through the annual fee mechanism. I'll grant you that.
And I think that's actually the more general framework. The most powerful businesses are the ones that blur the line between product and infrastructure. Amazon Retail is a product. Prime is the mechanism that makes it feel like infrastructure. AWS is infrastructure. The console and the services are the product layer that makes the infrastructure accessible. the genius is in the layering.
I think that's a better formulation than mine. The framework isn't product versus infrastructure. The framework is, how do you add infrastructure like switching costs to a product business? Amazon's answer is Prime for retail and proprietary APIs for cloud. Both mechanisms convert a transaction into a relationship.
That might be the best one-liner we've had on the show. Convert a transaction into a relationship. That's the whole game.
Write it down, put it on a t-shirt.
Let's talk about what a founder or an investor takes from this story.
The first lesson is about internal platform externalization. AWS exists because Amazon built internal tools to solve its own infrastructure problem and then recognized that the internal tools were a product. This pattern isn't unique to Amazon. Slack started as an internal communication tool at a gaming company called TinySpec. Google's MapReduce paper described an internal system that eventually became the foundation for the Hadoop ecosystem. The pattern is, if you're solving a hard problem internally, and the problem is general enough that other companies face it too, you might be sitting on a product.
And the key condition is the general enough part. Not every internal tool is a product. The internal tool becomes a product only when the problem it solves is universal, when the implementation is clean enough to be used by outsiders, and when the internal team has built it with enough abstraction that it's not tightly coupled to the parent company's specific use case.
Amazon's architectural decision to build internal services as clean, decoupled APIs was the precondition for AWS. If those internal tools had been tightly integrated into Amazon's retail application, if they were messy, coupled, single purpose, they couldn't have been externalized. The lesson for founders is, build your internal tools as if someone else might use them. Because they might.
The second lesson I want to highlight is about the low-margin deception. Amazon trained Wall Street to believe it was a low-margin company for nearly two decades. And during those two decades, Amazon used the perception of low margins to suppress competitive response. If your competitors believe you're not making money, they're less likely to fear you. They're less likely to invest in competing with you. They treat you as a market share-obsessed money loser rather than what you actually are, which is a high-margin business disguised by accounting consolidation.
I don't know if I'd call it deception. Amazon reports its segments as required by accounting standards. The information is available to anyone who reads the 10K filings.
But the narrative, Amazon doesn't make money, persisted for years even after AWS margins were publicly visible. The blended number was the headline. The segment data was in the footnotes, and most investors and most journalists read headlines, not footnotes.
Fair. The lesson is, blended financial metrics can be strategically misleading, and sophisticated operators know this. If you're evaluating a competitor, don't look at the consolidated margin. Disaggregate the segments. The answer is always in the segments.
Takeaways, you first?
My first takeaway is about the compounding of powers. AWS doesn't have one power. It has three: scale economies, switching costs, and counterpositioning, and they reinforce each other. Scale economies make the product cheaper. Cheaper products attract more customers. More customers generate more revenue. More revenue funds more data centers. More data centers increase scale. Simultaneously, every new service creates deeper switching costs, and the pay-per-use model prevents incumbents from responding. Each power makes the others stronger. The lesson is, a single power creates a competitive advantage. Multiple compounding powers create something closer to an impregnable position.
My first takeaway is about the internal tool insight. I talk to founders who are building internal tools all the time, and the question I always ask them is this tool specific to your business, or is it general enough that 10 other companies would pay for it? If the answer is 10 other companies, you might have a product hiding inside your operations. Amazon didn't set out to build a cloud computing business. They set out to solve their own infrastructure problem. The product emerged from the solution. And I think that pattern, products emerging from operational necessity, produces better products than products designed in a vacuum. Because the builder is the first customer. The builder knows the pain points intimately. The builder has already stress-tested the solution at scale.
My second takeaway is about cross-subsidization as competitive strategy. The companies that can fund money-losing operations with profits from adjacent high-margin businesses have a structural advantage that's nearly impossible to compete against. Amazon can price retail at zero margin because AWS and advertising generate the profit. This isn't predatory pricing in the legal sense. Amazon isn't pricing below cost. Amazon is pricing retail at cost and making its money elsewhere. But the competitive effect is similar. A pure-play retailer competing with Amazon on price is competing against a company that doesn't need to make money on retail. You can't win a price war against an opponent who has a different profit center.
And the Alexa story is the cautionary tale. Cross-subsidization enables bold bets, but it also enables bets that persist long past the point where they should have been killed. $10 billion on a voice assistant that never achieved its commerce thesis. That's the cost of having more money than discipline. The financial architecture is a weapon, but weapons can be pointed in the wrong direction. Throughlines, Throughline 7, long-termism compounds. AWS was funded by retail profits for years before it generated a dollar of its own. And Throughline 1, cloud infrastructure is the substrate of the AI era. AWS is to AI what Intel was to the PC.
Before we go, if you want to test whether you actually absorb the seven powers analysis we just ran through, the course has quizzes that test exactly that. Strategic pattern recognition across all 20 companies. SVStrategy.xyz. That's SVStrategy.xyz. Give it a look. Next time on the show, Facebook Part 1, Mark Zuckerberg, FaceMash, the newsfeed, and how a college directory for rating your classmates' attractiveness became the most important media company on Earth.
I've got complicated feelings about that one.
Everyone does. That's the episode.
We'll see you then.